Welcome in, Crimson Tide fans, to the 10th and final episode of Season 2 of the Alabama Adapted Athletics Podcast. As always, I'm your host, Dom Taylor. We have a great podcast coming up for you to finish the season off. Today, I'll be joined by sports psychologist Dr. Brett McCabe to get into several different fascinating topics pertaining to mental health and physical sports performance. But before we get into this episode, everyone in Alabama Adapted Athletics would like to thank this episode's sponsor, Hollister Incorporated. And I'll take this opportunity to tell you about one of their amazing products, the VaPro Plus Pocket Hydrophilic Intermittent Catheter, which provides discretion, ease of use, and 100% no-touch protection. So whatever you touch won't touch VaPro catheters. To learn more about Hollister and their continence care products and to find one that may work for you, visit Hollister.com or call 1-888-808-7456 to speak with a member of the Hollister team. Hollister Incorporated is a proud sponsor of Alabama Adapted Athletics. And now it is time to get right into the episode. And as I mentioned, with me today is licensed sports psychologist, author, speaker, business coach, amongst many other talents, Dr. Brett McCabe. Brett is a sports psychologist for the University of Alabama, including Alabama Adapted Athletics. And I just want to thank you so much for joining us on the podcast today.
Well, thanks for having me. It's an honor to come on and talk about some cool stuff.
Absolutely. It is really cool. And it's an area that I've thought for a while, just somebody who used to be an athlete in high school, and something that I don't think is talked about nearly as much as it needs to be, just because the focus in athletics is always on the physical side of things, primarily, at least in my opinion, that seems to be what's focused on. But the mental aspect is so big for athletes to not only understand, but for the fans as well, just to understand what these athletes go through on a daily basis. I think before we do get into that, though, Brett, if you could, for our fans, provide some background about yourself in terms of your education, your areas of expertise, and the experience that you've had prior to coming to the Capstone.
Absolutely. So I am a licensed clinical psychologist that specializes in sport performance, rehab, recovery, things like that. I was a baseball player at LSU. I was on a couple national title baseball teams. It was my own struggles, my own worries, my own anxieties, my own challenges post-injury that kind of turned me onto the mental side of the game. It became a spot for me to focus on what I needed to do to find a way to get on the field. And when I finally did that, I had a really, really solid last two seasons of my career. But unfortunately, after my injury, I wasn't good enough to go to the professional ranks, despite the fact that I had all the dreams and desires in the world to do it. So I decided to chase a PhD in clinical psychology. I did it at LSU. Specialized in a lot what we call health psychology or behavioral medicine. So people overcoming stroke, having chronic pain, medical conditions with a psychological component. And now we know that's kind of about everything. And so I did that. I did my internship. We psychologists do a one-year internship after completion of training. I did that at Brown Medical School up in Rhode Island through their psychology program. Then I worked in the pharmaceutical industry for 8 years doing research development, raising a family. And that brought me to Birmingham. And then I started seeing clients on the side. My boss allowed me to do that. And next thing I knew, I had this booming clinical and sports practice. So I only really focus on the performance side now, but my practice for the last 11 years has been professional athletes, college athletes. I've been the sports psychologist at the University of Alabama Athletic Department for the last 10 years. I can't believe it's been that long. I've been with you guys for 2 years. And you know, it's crazy to watch. And so I've got about 10 guys I work with on the PGA Tour, three in the top 12 in the world. And so I'm very honored to do what I do. And I think I stay committed. My whole goal is right. Is to help people realize what they're capable of doing, not about potential, but finding the best version of themselves in every challenge they have and seeing what that creates.
I think it was a speech or an area that you talk about is this this championship culture. Mm-hmm. And you've been a part of that, obviously, being here at the University of Alabama, but also in the past and playing at LSU and all the different areas that you've studied. What is it that players can take away from a championship culture, just in what you've experienced? And how do you usually go about giving that speech to people, and what are the things that people can take away from being in a championship culture?
Well, I was fortunate enough to play for a coach who was the Skip Bertman his name was Skip Bertman, but he was the Nick Saban of college baseball. And so he won five national titles in 10 years and went on to become the athletic director at LSU, which was an unprecedented thing. People, you know, baseball coaches don't go on to be the AD of a major Division I school. And he did. And it was because he had a vision, and he was eventually Coach Saban's AD at LSU. And unfortunately, Coach Saban took the job at the Dolphins while he was the AD, and he had to hire the next coach, which is an impossible task. But he led a massive capital campaign there. But one of the things that Coach really preached was he had what was called the system. Now, we know Coach Saban has the process, but Coach Bertman had the system. And we were trained from the minute we walked in the program to know that there is no one player bigger than the system. If you do the work, you trust the little things, you do the little things better than anybody else, you spend time where other people are afraid to be vulnerable, which are the details, the mental side of the game, the strategy, understanding what it takes to find out who you are, the system will work for you. But most people don't have the patience or the guts to stick at the bottom, to do it in the darkness. And we want immediate gratification. We live in a world where transfer of blame is the standard. It's the national pastime. It's not my fault. Somebody didn't play me. My coach screwed me over. My teacher gave me a bad grade. The government has wronged me, versus saying, you know, this sucks where I'm at, but I'm here and I have a choice on what I do. And so the system was everything about what we did as players. And it led us to five national titles in 10 years. And when you took a look at what we really had, a lot of people would look at LSU baseball and say, God, I mean, I just had some of the best players in college baseball. And that was absolutely not the truth. We had a bunch of local kids. I was one of the first or second guys from my high school to an all-boys Catholic school in Baton Rouge. And for the six national titles the baseball team has now accomplished, there's been one player on that team from my high school every single time. And we were local kids who bled purple and gold and would do anything it took to integrate into the program. And we would be patient and take our time. And then when we learned how to play the game, we got really good. Players today don't want to do that. And so there's not a big understanding of championship cultures of sticking with the system. You know, if you take a look at the football side of Alabama football, Coach Saban can, he can recruit people who are willing to put in the time and the effort because they've seen the track record. And we'll see players leave, but the players that stick it out tend to have success, right? But in today's culture, that's tough. So when we're trying to build championship cultures, too often players come into programs and they're worried about how soon they're going to play versus how much they can learn while they're waiting to play. Doesn't mean you shouldn't compete to play, but you should also look at it and say, if I'm not playing, it means I must get better. It's not because coach doesn't believe in me or screwing me over. That's the difference of what, how the system and the process works. And what we have to be patient, but we have to be stubborn. That's the issue.
Mm-hmm. Now, speaking on that, you talked about being in this area of the bottom. This sucks. And you have a book coming out of Suckville. I absolutely love that name. I love the way that's named. I think you also give speeches on this topic of coming out of Suckville, being at the bottom and doing the work at the bottom. And then, you know, sometimes not seeing the fruits of that work and getting to the point where you do eventually see the fruits of your labor. And so when you, first off, I'm interested in what the inspiration was for this particular book and this idea. And then how do you present this to athletes that might need this message? And what is so effective about this coming out of Suckville idea that can really help athletes get to where they want to be?
So Suckville started talking to some of my individual clients that I have in my practice. And what I noticed was that I had this rash of players who came to me who felt like they kept saying, I just don't feel like I'm reaching my potential. I just feel like every day I go up there and I strive and I fall short and I'm so frustrated. And they were just angry. And they're angry at themselves and they're angry at the circumstances. And what I started realizing was that every time that they would have a little bit of success, they would move that upper limit, that line that they would consider their potential, and they'd move it forward. Like if I went out and played in a basketball game and I scored 15 and played 18 minutes and I was really great on defense, now tomorrow I want to score 20 because I should do more. It's hard to look at it and say, well, tomorrow would actually struggle because we probably have expectations, right? But what happens is as we continue to push that potential up, what I'm potential, everyone says I'm capable. Everyone's told me I'm good enough. What happens is we reject our reality. the reality is where we are right now. And what that space between our reality and our potential is what I call Suckville, because you think that you suck. And people have to remember that when we start the process, whatever we're doing, whether it's a new job, a new opportunity, a new game, a new puzzle, whatever, there's a joy and there's an innocence that goes with it. But eventually it becomes a task. It becomes a job. I have to finish this by a certain amount of time. I have expectations to meet. I have to make a certain payroll. I have to win X number of games. I got to play this way or my coach isn't going to be happy. And then over time, that consistency becomes a burden. And that burden wears us down emotionally. And that's when we're really in the depths of Suckville, because we can't see growth, progress, and success because we're so focused on what we're missing. But what we fail to understand is the platform from which we're standing on can actually be a lot higher if we turn around and look at it and say, if I could just make today better, if I could just make this moment better, if I can just focus on the things and changing my perspective versus falling short, what am I capable of doing? You know, I still have the ability today to do something. I don't know what that is, but I still have the ability. And that's how I wanted players to break free. And what I have found is that the book resonates with a significant number of athletes, because so many athletes are putting so much pressure on themselves to perform at a level that they just simply cannot live up to. And I think some of it is the culture we live in today. We live in a culture where standards and expectations are through the roof for people. It's not okay to go get a job and make it when you're 50. You have to make it when you're 30. You know, you got to have a perfect score on the ACT and a 4.6 GPA or you're no longer good. You know, I went to a state school, I went to an LSU, it's Alabama, it's Auburn, it's Georgia and all that. But if you look at kids today coming out of high school, like my daughters did 5-7 years ago, there's a pressure to get into those state schools, right? It used to be when I was in school, it was like, oh yeah, it's a phenomenal school. You know, there's room, there's opportunities. Now it's this pressure to perform. And then not only that, it's the pressure to get the right internship. It's the pressure to get the right job. Nobody gives people the ability to improve. Everybody has to be at that level right now. And that's why we get stuck in Suckville, because we reject our reality so quick that we live with a burden. So it's probably a reason why we have such a mental health crisis going on in this world too, but that's a whole nother issue.
I want to get into that actually as we kind of move forward in this, because I think it's a very topical area right now. But obviously, tragically, just a few weeks ago, JMU softball player Lauren Burnett tragically took her own life. It's provided a national spotlight to the issues of mental health, not only in college athletics, but really just athletics in general and mental health in general. And as you said, there's this pressure as a society. We put so much emphasis on, we'll use the microcosm of college athletics because it's what is prevalent to this situation. But there's this myth that college athletes are essentially celebrities. We put so much pressure on them at a young age, and it's so much to deal with. In the talks that you've had with your athletes since then, and maybe even before this tragedy occurred, what perspectives have come out that you think would be helpful for people looking on the outside, looking in, to understand about what college athletes go through on a weekly basis dealing with their mental health?
And there was a very tragic case where a young lady died by suicide last week, Arlana Miller, a freshman student from Texas at Southern University in Baton Rouge, who was a cheerleader. And she shared a social media post that was haunting. And it was her goodbye letter and apology, not apology letter, but justification letter. And it's absolutely heartbreaking. It's just to hear her pain, right? We live in a world where we've come out of the most stressful 2-year period we've ever seen on record with COVID-19. We can argue the right, wrong, indifference of the policies and the procedures that went behind it. We can argue as to what the reaction was and if it was an overreach or if it was justified. That's not for me to decide. But what I do know is that the American Psychological Association has shown time and time again in their Stress in America studies that it was the most stressful record period of time on record, even greater than world wars, because we were dealing with a hidden virus that we didn't understand how it really transmitted and we didn't really know how to protect ourselves against it. And there were wide-reaching governmental policies that dictated how people should act, and then an extraordinary amount of judgmental social media being driven on both sides of the aisle for our own political gain. And it left people in the middle to say, I don't know what to do. Well, then we did the whole lockdown and we restricted and we limited, which is most people connect with other people for social support. Now we stripped them away. 9/11 challenged our ability to see security, but COVID-19 took our ability, our really ability to cope. And we saw increases in alcohol abuse and alcohol-related deaths, gun violence, and everything during this period. Well, we're going to be really emerging now with a social media, a mental health pandemic of likes that we've never seen. So anybody listening to this, I'm speaking from a point of, I really want people to listen to this, is that if you need help, please reach out to your doctor, reach out to a family, reach out to anybody. Rates of anxiety in our youth population, in my mind, are approaching the 40 to 60% range. I know that's a big number range, but it's true. The reason is that we prioritize perfectionism at such a high rate, and perfectionism works. It works until it doesn't work. And it works because it gets us over the top. And the standards by which we define ourselves now are not just local, they're international. I can go on social media and see somebody at my level competing against me and go, that's the person I compete against. When I competed, I'm almost 50. I mean, we just knew the people in our region, and we went to a national tournament. We're like, oh, these guys are good. Okay, but we didn't know every movement that they had, and we didn't leverage our social media. And we were not also subjected to online harassment, judgment, and critiques. So when we take a look at our student athletes of today, and even our professional athletes, what we have are people who it takes a tremendous amount of vulnerability to put yourself out in that setting on a daily basis, but to also compete without a guarantee. There's a lot of uncertainty over their value. There's a lot of uncertainty around their brand. There's a lot of uncertainty about their identity. Okay. And all those things are related, unfortunately, to how they perform on the field, despite the fact that we all say, don't do that, don't do that, don't do that. But come on, that's what we do, right? We wear the shirts with the logos on them because we want to be affiliated and associated with the brand. We want people to know we're successful. We drive nice cars because we want that level of enjoyment and pride. So that's who we are. But unfortunately, that's built on hollow ground. And so what happens is when we start struggling, we feel wrong for feeling the way we feel. Like, I have all this at my hands, but it's like, can I continue to live up to that standard each and every day over and over and over again? And it's that Suckville exhaustion that gets us. And as a result, when you take a look at this society that we live in of high demands, high expectations, high pressure to perform, an unknowing real criterion for what success is, because I've never met somebody who ever has enough, right? Coach Saban doesn't have enough national titles. He hasn't impacted enough players. Dana Duckworth and Sarah Patterson and Patrick Murphy have not impacted enough and won enough. They could win every game from here to life and they still won't win enough. Mm-hmm. They can impact positively every single player that they coach and they still won't impact enough, right? I mean, it's just who we are, right? As people. We move the line. And so we've lost our ability to cope. We used to cope by sitting around and talking, communicating, going to connect. We took that away from people. We live a schedule that there's no breaks. We have our phones that are connected to us, which has all the ability in the world to connect us just like this to you and me across, time zones. But the reality of the fact is we're never off. Somebody sends an email, we have to answer right now. We feel that urgency. It can't wait till tomorrow. Well, when you add that anxiety and that power storm building behind the scenes, you add that anxiety, that perfectionism, and those high standards and that inability to cope, starts building this level of depression that is pretty big because we feel helpless and we got a lot of hopelessness. That hopelessness is a challenge because it's like, is this ever going to get better? Like, where's the break going to come? I can make it to a vacation, but man, I mean, you're in school, you can make it to the break, but then it starts back up again. Okay. And then it's what's next. I got to get a job. I got to get this. I got to get on that hustle. And we start, and it's exhausting. And eventually people feel worn down. Then you add in the external stresses that happen. Well, it happens to student athletes. We used to think that student athletes were protected because we all were chasing our dream. But the reality is that we're finding the rates are equal to, or even more than, the student population. And really, I give a lot of credit to a website called the Players Tribune. It was started by the people behind Derek Jeter and him, where it gave athletes the opportunity to come on and talk just firsthand view. They own their stories, right? Well, it quickly transitioned to, here's my journey with anxiety. Naomi Osaka talking about burning out in the sport of tennis. Michael Phelps talking about depression and thoughts of suicide. Simone Biles talking about, you know, having so much anxiety she couldn't perform on a national stage. And the stories go on. And so what we're realizing now is that we have an epidemic not only in the population, but our student athletes are also high performers, highly perfectionistic. Every athlete I know in the adaptive program wants to be their absolute best at any given moment. They're overcoming challenges to perform at that level. Like, we all have our own unique challenges. Their challenges are just more visible, right? But yet they don't want to see the challenges. They want to see performance levels that they see in their mind that they're capable of. And when they fall short, they're frustrated. So, you know, it's all those things that you look at that we get to, and it's like, what do I need to do in order to perform at this level? And we need to give ourselves some more grace and realistic timeframes.
Now, who holds some of the keys in, I don't know if there's a fix. I think that's a very hard term to wrap around this issue, but maybe to improve some of these mental health issues in society, in terms of the pressure we put on ourselves, in terms of the wanting to be our best and to have the job and to have the right school and all of these different areas, who holds the keys to maybe alleviate some of that pressure? Does it fall on the coaches? Does it fall on parents to check in with their athlete more? Who do you think has some of the tools to help some of these crises in the younger generations?
You know, I don't know. I can point out the problem. I don't know if I know the answer yet. I think the answer is much larger. I think for the longest time, we looked at mental health as a sign of weakness, and we know that's the absolute furthest thing from the truth. And to that point, I think we also look at things that we do, and we have systemic issues in our country where mental health is never funded properly. Mental health should be treated like going to the dentist every 6 months. This is just my opinion. Every 6 months, you should be able to go to a therapist and have a check-in. And it's not, you know, you don't go to the dentist every 6 months because you got rotten teeth. You go every 6 months to make sure that your teeth two or three sessions from now are rotting.
It's true.
It's the same thing here. You know, we have record levels of stress. Think it institutions and companies, it's not about putting slides in the office. It's about giving people the respect to deal with what they are as individuals and humans, right? And, you know, if you're listening to this and you own a business, be a good human first. It's the simplest question first. Check and care for the people development and understand that they are not perfect and they don't need to be perfect, that they are all dealing with something. The problem with mental health is we can't see people's thought bubbles above their heads, right? We can't see the thought bubble above their head that's saying, you know what, I am hurting today, but I'm putting on a fresh face. What we know is that people, it wears on them. And it's kind of like the erosion oftentimes under a fence, a wall, that it eventually crumbles us. So I think we need to integrate much more effective programming of mental health in the elementary school settings. I would be a very strong advocate for introducing a level of mindfulness. I'm not talking about Buddhism or any secular based thing. I'm talking about just general mindfulness of being aware of what you feel, think, and breathe, and teaching conflict resolution at that early age. Kids are naturally going to separate from each other, and they're naturally going to, push cliques. I mean, if you've read Lord of the Flies, it happens for a reason. It's just the basics of human anatomy, or human physiology and psychology and sociology. But, you know, I think teaching people the way that we go about doing things and helping them cope to understand, you know, exercise used to burn off a good day's energy, but we don't exercise. We sit in front of a computer all day. We're not out in the fields. We're not working on the rail line anymore. We're not walking the streets anymore to get to work. And so we're nonstop. So I think early programming in schools, I think from a college coaching standpoint, high school coaching standpoint, regular check-ins with your players has got to happen. We got to look at them. Players today want to know where they stand at any given moment, and we really can't reassure them enough. And so I think as coaches, one of the things I train them is like, don't be afraid about once a week or every other week, have a sit down meeting with your players. It can be 5 minutes, man. How you doing? You doing good, Dom? Tell me what's going on. You know, listen, these are my plans for you the next 2 weeks. This is what I want you to focus on, because we're stuck as parents. We call and say, hey, how are things going? And usually when our kids are at college, all we hear is their negatives. Oh, it sucked. And we only hear the 90 We hear the 2-5% that was terrible. We don't hear the 95% that was great. So we need to, you know, give them that understanding of like, listen, you know, when you need to chat about something, I'm here, but here are some other people to reach out to. So, you know, I think those are the things to look at.
Now, from a social media perspective, you talked about sitting in front of screens all day. It really is something that in the last 20 years, my generation, the one just before me, and of course, all the ones coming after me, are all going to have this constant access to a phone, constant mm-hmm. access to live updates of what people are thinking verbatim, sometimes without filter. And we are getting that streamlined into our heads, essentially. I scroll Twitter and perfect example. I see, you know, Alabama softball is what comes into my head because, you know, just last week they went on a few game skid. They had a pretty rough week and it's something that's abnormal for the team. And so, you know, some of the less rational responses from fans were visible online.
Yep.
And of course those athletes
see coming that. Right after the JMU.
Right. Right after, tragedy. Which is just awful timing. And of course it really is a sign of what is wrong with this system of just non-mindfulness in tweeting, in posting, in all of these different ways that we communicate online. And so is there a way that you help athletes navigate social media and how they filter these things out, or what is your game plan in a sense?
Well, let me say one thing about social media, and I do have hope that Elon Musk is going to correct some of it. I think for the longest time I have said that Twitter is totally complicit in online bullying and the destruction of mental health due to the allowance of bots. I can create a bot that can come after anybody who says something positive about Alabama softball and go a vile comments up and name each and every player in there and be nonstop. There's no recourse for that. There's no coverage of that. But yet to me as a reader, it seems real. I don't know the difference. And even if I think it's a bot, it still stings and hurts. I think Twitter should be sued to complete oblivion in the previous ownership and the board for what they did to allow those bots to happen. I think it's going to look back. We're going to look back in 20 years and think it was one of the most heinous experiences of social sciences ever. That's my opinion because I've seen it. I've experienced it firsthand. And if you texted me as somebody I knew was you, it's one thing, but I don't know who dude with Mike 14-22-36 is saying about me, but it feels real, right? Okay. So that's what our athletes are dealing with in this world. They can handle booing. It's when you're sitting at dinner with your friends and family and the messages are hitting and the notifications, because those notifications, those likes, they trigger in the brain, much like reward does and success. I mean, we crave it. We want that social connection too. So with my athletes, what I try to do is help them understand. All my professional athletes, I try to give them to give up their Twitter password and their Instagram password to their team. They'll log in and they'll go on and they'll search, but they'll search things and we kind of watch how much they're on based on how much that they're losing focus. Only a few of them I've been able to be around that can really balance it, but they still wear it pretty hard. So I try to buoy them against it. I try to protect them, but I also don't think it's important to take away social media from kids. I think that's a bad mistake because we can't go away from the threats that are out there. They have to learn to deal with a-holes in this world. Okay. I just don't like artificial a-holes. I don't like people who are pretending to be real just for their own edification and joy. Just don't like that. I think that's wrong. And so when I look at that kind of stuff, you know, with my athletes, it's like, what do we need to do to get away? Where do we need to go to have our social support? Who's our team? That's why a lot of times there's a great motivational speaker out of Texas, a former NFL football player by the name of Trent Shelton. His thing is the bigger you get, the smaller your circle. Because really, how many people are in your circle who are there for them versus there for you? The people that are there for you don't need anything in return because they're there to serve. And that's the things that we look at, right? And so that's kind of what I'm trying to help them understand. I also have a lot of respect for them. I've battled anxiety my entire life. I think it's why I don't do full-time clinical work, because I can't shut off on a Friday night. I worry about my clients and my patients. I still do to this day. I work 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. But, you know, I think we have to be aware of who we are and embrace that. And it's okay to say I need a break, and it's okay to say I need time away type of thing.
Now, do you, just out of curiosity, since you bring that up, do you use some of your own advice and practices in your own life? Is that something that you try to implement on a daily basis when you're, you know, trying to give yourself a break or dealing with the anxiety and if depression has ever been an issue? And of course, I don't mean to pry, but
no, but I mean, I think my buddy who's a physician always tells me when we laugh about it, he's like, mm-hmm. you know, doctors who treat themselves have an idiot for a doctor and a fool for a patient. and that's true. I mean, you know, we don't have the objectivity to deal with our own stuff, but there are things that I do to just take care of myself on a regular basis. I try to use a form of mindfulness where I sit at my desk in the morning or a couple times during the course of the day. And I just allow myself to be present with where I'm at and just allow myself. I've done a lot of reading and appreciation for kind of the world of stoicism, which has really helped me in my anxiety, is to say, don't worry about what tomorrow holds. Just realize you can face it. Doesn't mean it's going to be easy, but it's doable. You can face it. It's not bigger than you. There's nothing you've ever faced that you couldn't work through. It doesn't mean it's going to be pretty, but you can work through it. And so it's those types of things, right? And so those are the things that I do. I'd love to say I have an exercise regime that I'm good with doing. I love to play golf. I'm actually off tomorrow to play in a little golf tournament. And so that is nice. I'm looking forward to that. I can do that. I've had to manage my schedule a little bit to allow me to have the freedom to not be so worn down, because I'm no good to the people I serve if I am. So, you know, I know what helps me. Unfortunately, I mean, we all have our areas where we get exhausted. And that exhaustion is, you know, some of the things that we have to be aware of. They're not a sign of problem. It's just a sign of a trigger. The trigger is, hey, this is a warning sign. And we got to focus on what we need to do.
Now, you mentioned playing golf, which is something that a lot of your clients, as you mentioned earlier in the episode, PGA Tour golfers, LPGA Tour golfers. It's a very interesting sport and a unique sport in just how mental and almost every stroke is so important. It's a very unique sport in that regard from what I gather. Obviously, you know it a lot better. What specific mental challenges do golfers have to overcome to compete at their best? What makes this such a unique sport from a mental perspective, and maybe some of the reasons why you've had so many clients and put so much emphasis on this sport in general? Why is that?
You know, I think it's, you know, I think what makes golf tough is that it's played over a 5.5 hour period, really 6.5 when you consider the time you got to warm up, but it's burst of energy in a short amount of time. And it's not reactionary. It's very responsive. You have to have a plan and be able to execute it. But in that plan, you have to be, you have to know what your strengths are. You have to know what you're capable of doing. And you have to have a clear intention of what you want to execute with. But then you also have to realize that you play, you have to look at and understand how we approach that. We're not in control of the outcome. We can control as much as we need to and fire a ball down the fairway and it bounces into two different directions. And next thing you know, we have a tough lie with an inaccurate yardage. And so, you know, those are the things that we look at and we say, you know, it makes the game it's like the game of golf is a little bit like playing craps. Craps is, you know, it's a game of chance, and that's what golf is. It's a game of percentages. PGA Tour players win 80% of their annual income in 5 events a year. So they play a lot of golf and they cash really good about 5 times.
Yeah. It's just a very interesting perspective. And just while I was going through it and researching, on your website and just preparing it, it was something that definitely caught my eye. So thank you for breaking that down. Just have a few more questions for you. And I appreciate your time. The mind side, that is something that I wanted to talk about as mm-hmm. well. Now, the mine site is, I guess you could probably clarify it a little bit for me. I know you have a location, your clinical office is the mine site, but is this also, is that a manifesto, something that you've created, a way of?
I had an office, and when COVID hit, I realized that most people didn't want to come in the office anymore. And what I really realized was I was in my office once every two weeks. Mm-hmm. And so I had about a nice 6,000 square foot spot with a putting green. It was a really cool place in Birmingham. And I realized I was never there. And my staff was there, my team was there, but they were really good working from home too. And so I felt it was silly to have them in the office and pay, you know, $10,000 a month of all the ancillary expenses, mm-hmm. when I could do that and be a better job serving my clients. So we had built a house. And so I built an office and we're finishing up a new section of the house that will allow me to do everything I want to do at home. But the mine site is, it was an approach. I wanted people to focus on the mental side of the game. Right. And it was kind of a play on the movie, The Blind Side, but it was really this idea that if we focus on the mind side of the game, we're going to have success. And that's something that I've really believed in over the last 11, 12 years, is that we should never separate the physical versus the mental. You know, now we take a look at strength and conditioning, and it's partly who we are, what we're doing, and everything, every aspect. But when I played, that was strength and conditioning was somewhat corrective. Somebody had a bad back, you went in there, you got stronger, but pretty much everybody did the same workout unless there was an issue. Well, that's how we've treated the mental game for so long. Everybody does the same thing until there's an issue. I really want to see the mind side become like strength and conditioning, where from the minute somebody comes into a program, into a high school, into a thing, it's like, I already work with a mental guy. You know, I would advocate that the mental guy be a licensed provider just because of safety and all that, but I can't control that world. But, I think it's, there's a lot of value in it. I think shows like Billions, stuff like that with Wendy Rhodes, and those have all highlighted the power of performance coaching, which has been around a long time in a lot of different settings. But, you know, I think what happened was about 8 years ago, I wrote a book called The Mindside Manifesto, which was this idea that was based on very few people really admit what they truly want to accomplish in life. And so if you ask people, what do you want? They're like, whatever. It's like, no, tell me what you want. And it's hard for people to say that. If somebody came and said, it started a little bit from a physician that was one of the most dynamic leaders ever, Frieda Lewis Hall, that I worked with under at Bristol Myers Squibb. And she used to look at the audience and said, and I'll never forget it, she said, you know, so many of you are in the audience thinking about what your next opportunity is. I want you to think about what your last opportunity is and build the skills necessary to dominate it. And that was the question of, what do you want? And everybody, I just want to get the next job. I just want to go there. But they don't really have a vision. Like, I knew what I wanted to do in this field, and I wasn't afraid to share it. And people thought I was crazy, but that's okay. I'm not even halfway there. I'm not even close to where I want to go. But it's taken me some time to build the image that I want to create. But I, at the end of the day, I want people, my ultimate goal, my ultimate vision is that athletes that I interact with, people that hear me talk, coaches, that if I can touch them in a positive way on their mental side of their game, that in 5 or 10 years, if they need something in their mental health, they go, you know, I remember working with Brett. That was a really cool experience. Let me see if he knows somebody I can go see, so I can open them up a little bit to what it takes to be a little bit more successful. So the manifesto kind of was a compilation of what I did in the mind side, and it's just kind of continued to grow from there.
Hmm. Now, where do you want to go? Where do you see yourself? What is the ultimate place that Brett McCabe ends up at the end of your career? I know you talked at the beginning about Nick Saban never has enough wins and Dana Duckworth never has enough wins. For you, I'm assuming you've probably never helped enough people that it's not possible to fill that number. Where do you want to see yourself grow by the end of your career?
I want to have a better ability to communicate on a larger platform. It doesn't mean standing in front of stages. I mean, I don't mind. I love standing in front of stages. That's not the issue. But I want to get better material out that helps people reach inside themselves and understand who they are at a better and easier access. I want people to realize that that their mental side, their mind side of their life is their strength, and that the what they're feeling and who they are is who they are. That doesn't mean it's wrong. It doesn't mean it's deficient. It doesn't mean anything. What it means is just is unique to them, is their own fingerprint. their psychological fingerprint is their complete unique side. So whether that's writing, speaking, podcasting, video casting, all the above, those are the things that I want to do, because I know that not everybody can afford to come see me, and I don't have enough time, or my colleagues don't have enough time to see people. But if somebody who's sitting in a sophomore high school baseball field and is frustrated because they doesn't understand what their coach wants and is doubting themselves, is that they can listen to something and say, you know what, I understand. There's a clear pathway. It's not written in psych language. It's written in human language. And it's real. And it's not somebody who's, you know, afraid to communicate. You know, I love my profession to death, but sometimes we talk in very abstract terms that clients look back afterwards and go, I don't understand what I'm supposed to do. And so for me, I've always tried to just say, like, I went to LSU. I'm not very smart, but what I know is I know how to communicate. and you know, it's, I've learned from one of the greatest from LSU, a guy by the name of James Andrews, who's probably the preeminent leader in orthopedic surgery. He's now based in Birmingham and Gulf Breeze, Florida, is be the best communicator and connect to people and serve what they need. And you do those things. That's what I want to do. You know, I want people to realize that we should have a place like University of Alabama Athletic Department, University of Alabama Adaptive Athletics, where we take the mental side seriously. It's not lip service. It's not a back room. It's everything that we do. It's incorporated in everything we do because it's that important to us. Because I want everyone to realize they don't need to be feeling off to focus on their mental game. They don't need to wait till their house is on fire to focus on their mental game. They need to focus on who they are right here, right now, to make themselves better. And that's the platform that I want to continue to build.
To end this podcast, I'm interested to hear what your why is. Why do you wake up, and for the last few decades you've worked in this profession, you have studied, you've worked with tons of different clients in different areas. For what I want to do, I have a why, because I love how sports affects the communities around surrounds the communities. It works almost in tandem. You know, the sports team gives back to the community. The community loves the sports team. I get to cover that. That's my why. That's why I do it. What is your why? Why do you love sports psychology and just what you can do for athletes?
Well, I mean, I think it's just tapping into, you know, helping people understand that they've got a navigator to help them manage the rough road ahead. Because, you know, whoever sold us that do what you love and you'll never work a day in your life are only the people who are at the end. It's not the people in the middle of it, right? Because there's days I wake up and I'm like, God, I got to go to work today. I mean, I've had a couple really long days, and just in the last 2 days. But it's one of those things that you look at and you're like, at the end of the day, if I can shine a light into one area of some person's life to help them realize that they can believe in themselves and understand who their self-image is, that they can prepare themselves to face any challenge before me, it doesn't necessarily mean that they would improve, succeed, or dominate, but instead that they can face it, then yeah, I'm all about it. That's I'm all about.
I love it. Well, Brett, I want to thank you so much once again for joining us here on the Alabama Adapted Athletics podcast. And fans, you can find out more about Dr. McCabe at brettmccabe.com. That's BHRETTMCCABE.com, brettmccabe.com, to find out about his books, coaching opportunities, speaking opportunities, booking options, services, and more. And once again, thank you to Hollister for being the sponsor of this episode. We really appreciate your support. Brett McCabe, thank you so much for joining us. That's all for the Alabama Adapted Athletics podcast, and we will be back with more content next season. Roll Tide.